Hello, everyone. It's my pleasure and delight to welcome you to this program, New Rules for a New World. Will COVID-19 make international arbitration better, faster, and cheaper? My name is Rekha Rangachari. I'm the Executive Director of the New York International Arbitration Center, or NIAC. Thought leadership has long been an important component of the work we do at NIAC from our perch in New York, and book releases are really a special treat. Apropos, as we've pivoted into virtual in both our professional and our personal spheres, best practices take center stage. It's a time not only to glean whether a pandemic necessarily pushed us, as one positive note, to utilize existing rules and adapt others, so we can go live from New York City, DC, London, Hong Kong, or otherwise. The book on the table today, The International Arbitration Yearbook, A Guide to Arbitral Regimes, published on October 24th, 2019, and available for purchase on many sites, including Wolters Kluwer and Amazon. Our moderator for this session, the lovely Tian Bao, independent arbitrator and mediator with Arbitration Chambers based in Hong Kong. She wears many hats within the international arbitration space, including as Global Advisory Board member of NIAC, and she was a former Secretary General of the HKIAC. I offer my thanks to the Decker team for bringing us live today and to hand over the mic to Tian. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rekha, and thank you very much for being here today. I am so pleased to have been invited to moderate this panel, which was inspired by the book that I have personally enjoyed, the International Arbitration Rulebook, as Rekha has described. For those of you who are not familiar with this book, I highly encourage you to pick it up. This book really gets into the essence of arbitration institutions and their functions in the arbitration system. Most of what you will see from a commercial perspective are the rules and the operation of the rules. Certainly, there are many similarities, and this publication covers them comprehensively. However, behind the rules and the case management lies the history and the governance of the institution. This is equally important as it gives the users a sense of why things work at the institutions in the way they do. I particularly appreciate several features of this book. One, I really appreciate the fact that it describes the powers and the duties of the institutions featured. Very few publications have distilled exactly what the powers and duties are, and the way in which these they have been done by the authors really expresses how involved institutions are in the arbitral process and how there are real decisions to be made and how they are made. Two, there is a chapter on arbitration agreements, and this chapter provides model arbitration agreements and gives you a step-by-step process as to what one might expect in arbitration agreements. And of course, there is three, the arbitration procedure itself. And there are several chapters that are comprehensively covering the area of arbitration procedure from the initial procedural conference to the appointment of arbitration procedures, etc. Now, we have the authors here today to discuss the topic of the day, the arbitration institution in the COVID era. The speakers are Arif Ali, Global Co-Chair of Decker's International Arbitration Practice Group, together with Eduardo Silva Romero. Arif is an active arbitrator and counsel. As counsel, he has first chaired numerous investor state, commercial, and construction arbitrations under the rules of all of the major arbitration institutions. As arbitrator, Arif has arbitrated disputes governed by civil, common, and Islamic law regimes, as well as international law. He is a vocal advocate for gender, culture, and cultural and ethnic diversity in international arbitration. As the initiator and lead author of the rulebook, I will be asking Arif as to what motivated his project and what he sees to be the significance of the study he and his co-authors conducted to the future of international arbitration practice. The next speaker we will have is Jane Wessel, a partner at Arnold & Porter in London. She is a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators and is a CEDAR-accredited mediator. and has more than 25 years of experience in international commercial arbitration and CITESes around the globe and involving all major arbitration institutions, in addition to an active English court practice in international matters. Most recently, she has been acting as in the arbitration enforcement proceedings and high-profile litigation for the administration of interim president Guaido of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Alex de Gramont is the next speaker, and he is a partner of the International Arbitration Group at Deckert in Washington, D.C., who handles both international commercial and investor state arbitration. Alex started off his career in 1991 as a general litigator, focusing on complex commercial matters in U.S. federal courts. About 20 years ago, he started working on international arbitration cases, which now comprise over 90% of his practice. Ryan has a decade of practice experience acting on international arbitration matters and cross-border litigation. His experience includes international dispute resolution in diverse sectors and jurisdictions governed by treaties and contracts under the rules of ICSID, ICC, ICDR, and the ICJ. Prior to founding Flex Arbitry, Ryan trained at White & Case and Three Crowns. Leading international arbitrator Jan Paulsen has said, if there were two Ryans, we'd hire both of them. Also a senior lecturing fellow at Duke University Law School, Ryan teaches and writes on international arbitration. He is fluent in Spanish, having lived and worked in Spain and Latin America. He is licensed to practice in New York State and Washington, D.C. Now, let me begin with you, Arif. Why was this book needed? Tell us more about what was the inspiration for this book and how it came to be.
Well, Chan, thank you very much. And before I answer the question, allow me to thank Nayak and Rekha for organizing this event and for the incredible support that they've provided. And the institution of Nayak, I think, has been an incredibly valuable one in terms of thought leadership, as Rekha said. But I think in also in terms of ensuring that as a community, whether it's through the physical gatherings or our virtual gatherings, we're able to continue to participate and contribute ideas. And so I think Nayak has been a very, very valuable addition to the firmament of, arbitral bodies, not in terms of administering arbitrations, but in terms of thought leadership. And Rekha is certainly a very experienced international arbitration thought leader, and thank her for her leadership. And Chan, it also is a great pleasure for us to have you as our moderator. And I've always admired your insights. From the perspective of having led an institution, as well as an arbitrator who has well managed to bring together, I think, the cross-cultural issues that we confront in our international practice. I'd also like to thank the audience. We have quite a few that have dialed in from around the world. So thank you very much for sharing the next hour and a half with us. And of course, I'd like to thank my co-authors, all of whom are dear friends, and all of whom really allowed this project to evolve in a way that led to a product that I could never have imagined when this project started. And most of all, I'd like to thank them for the constancy of encouragement, and finally for insisting that we shouldn't allow perfection to get in the way of progress, with the constancy of their, okay, RF, it's time to just get this thing done and to the publisher. But what they contributed substantively and through their vast experience, I think has made the book something that we think will be very useful to practitioners. So how did the book come about? It came about largely as a result of my teaching at various institutions and focusing a lot on arbitral procedure, and realizing that there were many texts that are fantastic in terms of dealing with individual institutions. There are, of course, arbitral treatises that deal with arbitral jurisprudence writ large. There are also a number of books that set out tables that are cross-comparative insofar as the different institution rules and ad hoc rules are concerned. But there didn't seem to be, at least, you know, I was unable to find any study on an analytical basis of the rules themselves on a comparative, let's say through a comparative law and a comparative regulatory perspective. And so that's ultimately what led to the project being undertaken. I think what we then, I think that we also wanted to organize a volume that would be very useful to not only academics and practitioners, but to the users of international arbitration. And as you'll see from the table of contents, what we have, what we wanted to do was to give those who don't know much about international arbitration a sense of how the different arbitral institutions operate, how they're governed, and what the differences are between them in terms of their governance structures and their administrative approaches to case administration. We wanted to then organize the rules in a way that allow those who are involved in negotiating arbitration clauses and arbitration agreements with a frame of reference, so that as they negotiate these clauses, they're able to see what the differences are between the rules. And there are indeed many similarities, also many differences, and those differences can be quite, if one is aware of what those differences are, can be of enormous strategic importance as one negotiates an arbitration agreement. And as we know, it's not always the arbitration practitioners who are involved in negotiating these arbitration clauses, but our transactional colleagues. And we thought that bringing together the various rules and providing guidance and model clauses for our transactional colleagues would be of great benefit. And then the book addresses the arbitral procedure, everything from the filing of a request for arbitration, amended requests, the answer, amended answers, the formation of the arbitral tribunal, the challenges to arbitrators. And I think the chapter on challenges is actually very interesting in terms of looking at the differences in approach as well as the standards that are applied by different institutions. And I should note also that as one looks at the different arbitral regimes, there is a enormous difference in terms of how didactic particular rules are. Let's say one takes the ICC rules that are more broad-based compare those to the ICDR rules, which are far more didactic and detailed. These reflect particular cultures in terms of the development of the rules. Insofar as challenges are concerned, we'll also see that the different institutions have different standards, albeit at bottom they may have a certain, let's say, common foundation. Ultimately, the particular words that were used by the rule framers and drafters do have significance, and we can get into some of those later on. I think that you'll find that across the rules, there are, let's say, you take the CTAC rules and the enormous emphasis that they place on good faith, which is interesting. I mean, we all know that we are, as international practitioners, bound to come before international tribunals with clean hands and to advocate in good faith, but the CTAC rules themselves actually emphasize those sorts of that particular principle. So, I mean, of course, we had to make some choices in terms of the rules that we included. There are many regimes that could be included, and as those who will be charged with taking forward the next edition will, I'm sure, do, they will add other rules to the mix of rules. And what we're hoping will happen with this book is that CLURA will be working with us to actually create a tool whereby parties will be able to access the rules, be able to select certain rules, and then the accompanying analysis of those rules will follow. So that's a little bit about the book. I think that what we hope will be achieved is that there will be, through the similarities that we have identified amongst the rule regimes, a sense of a common, say, procedural framework that is developing, and that will lead to greater predictability in terms of arbitral procedures, but that there will also be a basis for innovation. And ultimately, we know that all the arbitral institutions are, in a certain degree, competing with each other, and competition leads to innovation. Innovation, as we've seen in particular in the arbitral area and the institutional area, leads to emulation. And emulation ultimately to a degree of homogenization, and homogenization to predictability. And as those who, as arbitrators and as advocates and as users of international arbitration, what we want is flexibility, but we also want predictability. Now, Anshan, please do let me know if I'm getting close to the end of my allotted time. So I don't want to take away from others. So when we defined this particular title for this event, New Rules for a New World, Will COVID-19 Make International Arbitration Better, Faster, and Cheaper? It was driven by the notion that there is a new normal. But I think, as I've reflected on the past 9 months, it struck me that, you know, every second of our human existence is a new normal. We are constantly evolving. And human ingenuity matched with our innate competitive spirits has led us over millennia to meet new challenges and situations. And this is really no different. I think that there's a lot that we have learned through as we have tried to meet the challenge of the pandemic. Amongst the lessons that I've learned is that the arbitral regimes as they currently exist across the board are adequate to address the challenges of virtual hearings and of the pandemic. I think that there will be innovation, and I know that Jane will be addressing some of those innovations and insofar as the LCI rules are concerned. But I think that the other regimes have a framework that is more than adequate to allow arbitrators and the institutions themselves to continue to administer arbitrations in a way that meets the challenges that the pandemic has created in terms of time zone management and travel and the absence of physical connection that comes from being in a hearing room together. As an arbitrator, I must say that what I've experienced and seen is that virtual hearings that we are now having to contend with has certainly led to greater calendar flexibility, and it's led to a significant degree of cost savings. Recently, Alex and I were involved in an arbitration where the seat is London. We had to conduct the arbitration over multiple time zones and without anybody traveling to London, and the ultimate cost of the platform that we use was less than $30,000 for a 10-day hearing, whereas it would have been close to $250,000 or more if one took into account travel costs and the other costs associated with moving entire teams to London for a physical hearing. Now, certainly we've lost the benefit let's say, the warmth of human interaction, or if those of you who watched the U.S. presidential debate last night, the fire and brimstone of human interaction in contentious settings, we've lost a certain degree of the insights that one gets, and this is, I speak as an arbitrator as well as counsel, from not being able to view, to feel the room, to be able to sense a witness, to be able to use our human instincts in the way that we have. But I think that as we get more and more used to dealing with hearings remotely, we'll develop new instincts, and the technology will improve, and we will begin to morph and appreciate what it is that we've lost, and that there's also a lot that we will have gained. There are many challenges that have arisen as a result of virtual hearings and the pandemic. I think that those challenges and the case management issues that they have raised have been dealt with by a number of protocols. I would recommend to the audience and to that they take a look at the protocol for virtual hearings that's been put together by a friend of many of ours, Sama Haridi, and her colleagues at Hogan Lovells. It is an excellent protocol that identifies a number of issues that arbitrators should take into account, and I think that institutions should be taking into account as they develop their own protocols and develop their own and evolve the rules. I've also come to appreciate the importance of those who are in the technology support arena. And I think that this is something that arbitral institutions will need to focus on. Not only will the arbitrators and counsel need to become extremely familiar with the technology and the strategic advantages that mastering the technology provides, and actually inserting the technology into their advocacy, and their case strategies. But I also think that arbitrators will need to understand how best to use the technology, the differences in technology platforms, in order to run hearings that will ensure that parties have a full and fair opportunity to present their cases. So, you know, we've learned a lot. I think that we have systems in place that are you know, certainly have met the challenges. I think that there's also quite a bit that we don't know. We don't know the degree to which the Lex Loci arbitri will apply to the arbitration at the seat of arbitration, will accommodate and tolerate virtual hearings. There's no comprehensive study of that nature as yet, and I think that that's something that we will need to look at. If we use the Unstrel model law as a proxy, take a look at Article 18 of the Unstrel model law, which requires the equal treatment of parties. It states the party shall be treated with equality, and each party shall be given a full opportunity of presenting his case, I should say its case. So, you know, to the extent that the Unstrel model law is a basis for the laws of a governing arbitration in a particular jurisdiction, I think that we will need to assess the degree to which courts and arbitrators how they will assess the requirement of a full opportunity for a party to present its case. Does the use of a virtual hearing or the necessity of proceeding virtually deprive a party of a full opportunity to present its case? There are requirements in arbitral laws that relate to the oath that a witness can take. Will the oaths that we are now requiring witnesses to take be sufficient? Will they comply with the local requirements? Will they be respected in jurisdictions where arbitral awards are taken for enforcement? So probably the biggest X factor out there for me is how courts will address challenges to awards based on due process and public policy considerations. And I think that we need to reverse engineer from that assessment in terms of then fashioning the arbitral proceedings that that we all participate in as administrators, counsel, and arbitrators. So with that, Chan, I will stop and pass the mic on to Jane. Thank you.
Thank you, Arif, very much. Yes, thank you. Just following up on Chan's very generous remarks about the book, one part of the book, one section that I would particularly highlight is Chapter 8, where we deal with costs. A number of people who've reviewed the book have commented to me that it is incredibly useful when considering different institutions for different disputes. And I'm not aware of any other publication which has looked at costs in the way that we've done there. So I just mentioned that in passing as perhaps my favorite chapter of the book, if I'm allowed to have one. So my topic is around the brand new revisions to the LCIA rules. The LCIA announced on the 11th of August this year amendments to the 2014 rules, which will become effective at the beginning of 2021. Obviously, these rule amendments had been in the works for a considerable time before the new world took us all by storm in March of this year. But it's remarkable that a number of the changes that have been made to the rules do reflect the new normal that Arif spoke about just now. And that, I think, underscores the fact that these changes were on their way. Perhaps they wouldn't have come quite as quickly as they have forced themselves upon us. But probably the innovations that have been adopted by the LCIA were going to come anyway. Some of them have been reinforced by the current situation. So what are they? Well, there are five major areas in which the LCIA is amending its rules. Firstly, on expedition of arbitration proceedings. Now, we all know that under the existing rules, arbitrators have always had, at least implicitly, a great deal of procedural power to fashion an arbitration in an expedited way. But what the new rules do is they codify some new tools for arbitrate that are available to arbitrators when considering how expedition might take place. So there are new provisions in Articles 14 and 15 of the LCIA rules that give explicit powers for the tribunal to take control of ensuring that the arbitration is conducted in a manner which is fair, efficient, and expeditious. So instead of merely having a vague duty on all parties to do whatever they can to make sure the arbitrations are fair, expeditious, and efficient, that there are now powers for the tribunal to employ to ensure that that is the case. It's more a change of focus than anything particularly innovative, but I do think it's a welcome alteration. So there's much more meat to this than the previous general duty, and there are explicit powers on the tribunal to limit the length of witness statements, to limit or to dispense with witness statements, to limit oral evidence, to decide at which stage particular issues should be addressed, and indeed to dispense with hearings altogether. Now, some of those provisions will doubtless be used by tribunals with some caution, not least because of national arbitration law provisions, such as Article 18 of the UNSTRAL model law, which require parties to have a full opportunity to present their case. So tribunals will have the difficult task of balancing their duty to ensure that the proceedings are fair, efficient, and expeditious against complaints by somebody whose presentations are being limited in the ways that I've just outlined. These aren't really revolutionary changes, but they are a welcome shift in focus, I think, with an emphasis on cost saving and expedition. Also in this category, there's a new provision in the LCIA rules on early determination. Similarly, this may raise Article 18 of UNSTRAL model law issues if a party doesn't feel it's had its full say. But the new LCIA provision is really following on from the example that's been set in SEAC and the Hong Kong International Arbitration Centre and in the ICC practice note on this topic. So here a tribunal can dismiss a claim if it's, quote, manifestly without merit. Now, we can all anticipate that there's going to be an enormous amount of discussion around what those words mean and whether a certain claim is within that standard and so subject to being dismissed early or not. Query whether having such a standard is going to lead to efficiencies or if it's going to lead to a whole host of satellite disputes around the application of the standard. We shall see. There's also a new obligation on the tribunal to endeavour to issue an award within 3 months of the final submissions of the parties. We know from the LCIA statistics that the median time for an LCIA arbitration tribunal to issue an award is indeed 3 months after the final submissions. So query whether this will actually change anything. There will always be outliers in particularly complex cases where an award will take longer. Although having this obligation on the tribunal would, it is to be hoped, eliminate the very rare cases where tribunals take very much longer than that amount of time. And I think we've all experienced some of those and the frustrations, both for counsel and for clients, which arise because of delayed awards. So in that first category of changes on expedition, there's a very good chance that those are going to lead to arbitrations being better, faster and cheaper, subject to, in particular, I think, disputes around the meaning of manifestly without merit for the early determination part of that. The second category of innovations is a thorough embracing of the increased use of technology for arbitrations, with virtual hearings and electronic communications being absolutely the norm in the LCIA rules. And indeed, for the request for arbitration and the response, one has to ask for permission from the LCIA to submit those documents in a non-electronic form. This has to, I think, lead to cheaper arbitration simply because we're not cutting down so many trees and paying for the costs of all the copies of the papers. I think this is very much a reflection of what people are actually doing in practice, which is now being embodied in the rules. So not really new, but a welcome confirmation of what's already happening, and certainly faster and cheaper, I think. Better, I don't think much is changing there. The third category is an expansion of the existing rules in the 2014 rules on consolidation and concurrent arbitrations. This is always a tricky area because, of course, when one has consolidation of arbitrations, one has different interests. One has the issues around how the tribunal is to be appointed when there are more than two interests involved in the case. But the LCIA has added a new category where consolidation can be ordered. Where there are compatible arbitration agreements and either the same parties or disputes which arise out of the same transaction or series of transactions. This seems to me to be very sensible, subject to sorting out the questions about tribunal appointments. Because as we all know, there are very frequently disputes that involve multiple contracts, maybe between different entities within the same corporate groups, sometimes with others as outliers. But it's essentially all the same dispute, even though formally there are different agreements involved. So the efforts the LCIA is making to try and allow for further consolidation there, I think is very welcome. And the LCIA has also clarified that it's possible to have a composite request for arbitration. In other words, a request for arbitration that refers to more than one agreement to arbitrate. That's particularly an issue in England, where a case that delights in the name of A versus B in 2017 was decided by the High Court in a way that said that the LCIA rules do not allow composite requests for arbitration, which I think was news to the LCIA. So the rules have now been clarified. That issue has gone away. The LCIA rules now very clearly say composite is fine. So you can have a single request, even though more than one arbitration agreement is involved. That's bound to be faster and cheaper and better, in my view. So that category of amendments are also very welcome and I think will improve the efficiency of arbitration. The other two categories are fairly minor. First of all, tribunal secretaries are now explicitly dealt with in the LCIA rules in a new Article 14A, which sets out the parameters for what the tribunal secretary can and can't do, for how agreements should be reached for the appointment of a tribunal secretary. This category of changes is really merely acknowledging what's already happening on the ground, I think. So it's better because there are now clear rules in the LCIA. Faster or cheaper? No, I don't think so, because these rules merely echo the reality on the ground. Finally, there are some very important changes around data protection and other regulatory requirements, such as money laundering, terrorist financing, and so forth. There's been a growing concern in our international arbitration community around those regulatory concerns in international arbitration. And we now have a new Article 35, 30 brackets 5, that is, not 35, which require the tribunal to consider those regulatory matters, and a new 30 brackets 6, which permit either the LCIA or the tribunal to make binding orders dealing with those regulatory matters. So those were, I think, very necessary changes to ensure that the LCIA and the parties are abiding by those required regulations. So in summary, nothing terribly revolutionary in these changes, lots of recognition of what's already happening in arbitrations and a reflection on those, and certainly some changes which are aimed at ensuring that arbitration is better, cheaper and faster. What is annoying about these rules and every other change of rules is that it means we have to issue a new edition of the book, because as these rules change, I see wry smiles from my fellow authors. As these rules change, which they do very frequently, obviously the detail of what the current rules are changes. We need to change the rules in the way they're reflected in the book. What doesn't change, though, is the analysis, because I do feel the analysis that we have in the book still applies and will just require tweaking. With that, I will pass the baton on to Alex.
Thank you so much, Jane, and thanks to everyone, both to NIAC for hosting, for all of you in the audience, for joining us. I appreciate Jane's last comment about the challenges of preparing a comparative study of all these different rules when the rules often change. But for me, the main value of a comparative study is to see how different regimes approach the same problems, the same procedures, because there is some room for mixing and matching, for taking ideas from one set of rules and perhaps incorporating them, whether it's in the arbitration agreement, whether it's at the first procedural conference. Ultimately, understanding the different approaches helps us to design a more flexible arbitration regime to be tailored to the particular case at hand. Now, what we see across all of the rules is great flexibility. Right. The LCIA rules, for example, says that the tribunal has the, quote, widest discretion to discharge its general duties, obviously within the parameters of the applicable arbitration law and the parties' agreement. But tribunals have tremendous discretion, and that is reflected across all of the rules. So all of the rules provide for and leave room for the parties and the arbitrators to be creative and innovative, to make the arbitration less expensive and more efficient. That's not the primary goal in every case, but it is important even in the largest cases. As Jane and R have suggested, faster and cheaper doesn't always mean better. The goal is to achieve all three of those things. And the truth is, we have all talked for years about how to make arbitration, international arbitration, faster and cheaper. And perhaps we have made some progress, but in candor, it's been slow. I mean, the reality is that all of us tend to cling to what we know best. And yet, in the past 6 months or so, I've seen more creativity and more innovation in international arbitration than I have seen in the past decade. We are being forced by the crisis to take risks that we never would have taken before. For the most part, those risks, in my view, have worked out pretty well. For the most part, they have saved time and money without compromising the quality of the arbitration. Prior to the COVID crisis, I think that very few of us would have voluntarily conducted a high-stakes arbitration by virtual means. It just seemed too risky. But now we've been forced to do it. And for the most part, it works reasonably well. There may be cases where it's inappropriate, where a party has the right to object to some or all of the proceeding being conducted virtually. And I know Ryan's going to talk about that. But for many cases and for many procedures within cases, it works really, I think, quite well. And so when we look to the different rules, the different regimes that are covered in the book, we see other innovations that were seldom used in the past, but that parties and tribunals are now using to meet the demands of the crisis. And I suspect that many of those will survive the crisis and will continue to be used after the crisis. So let me give a few examples. One example is the increased use of and the more flexible use of expedited procedures. Right, most rules provide for expedited procedures for smaller cases. They automatically apply to cases where the amount alleged to be at issue falls under a certain threshold. So, for example, the current ICC rules automatically apply their expedited procedures to cases that where the dispute is worth less than $2 million. The ICDR uses a somewhat different approach. They apply the expedited procedures to cases where no claim or counterclaim exceeds more than $250,000 per claim, but all of the rules that have expedited procedures set some sort of monetary threshold. And the expedited procedures can yield an award, in my experience, roughly 4 to 6 months, pretty quick. Now, parties can jointly opt out of the monetary threshold. They can agree to the expedited procedures even if the amount in controversy is worth more than the threshold. But prior to the crisis, I at least had never seen that done. Now, based on our collective experience and anecdotal evidence, parties are opting into the expedited procedures for significant cases on a much more frequent basis. Because of the crisis, parties need to get disputes, even large disputes, resolved quickly. So, again, they are taking risks that they might otherwise not have taken. And I think for the most part, those risks are paying off. The procedures are faster and quicker. They are maybe less fulsome, but the upside, I think for the most part, outweighs the downside. Now, there are other innovations. I mean, the use of virtual hearings is a rather extraordinary innovation in and of itself, with all of the hearings that we're now conducting being heard virtually. But the existence of virtual hearings opens up all sorts of opportunities for other innovations that didn't exist before. Many of you have probably heard of the term Kaplan opening. It's the innovation of Neil Kaplan, who's a very well-known arbitrator and a former high court judge in Hong Kong. And this is how it works. At some point in advance of the actual evidentiary hearing, perhaps after the first round of opening submissions or after the first round of memorials, the parties come before the tribunal. This is way in advance of the evidentiary hearing. They come before the tribunal and they give opening arguments at a relatively early juncture of the case. And it's a great idea. It accomplishes a lot of great things. It gets the tribunal familiar with the facts of the case early on. It makes the parties focus on what's important in the case early on and to get a sense of what's most interesting, most challenging for the tribunal. And given that the parties have presented their respective cases early on, it can also facilitate settlement. But if everyone has to travel to Paris for the Kaplan opening, which is what we had to do when we did our first Kaplan opening, it can be an expensive proposition. And so in the past, I suspect the Kaplan openings were used mostly for, you know, high value, very complex cases where it was worth spending the time and money to do it. But in a world where everyone is used to virtual hearings, where everybody is familiar with the platforms and not at all uncomfortable with it, it's much easier to do a Kaplan opening on a given morning or afternoon where people don't have to travel. And in that world, it can and should be used a lot more widely. And I will say as a general matter, it's a good thing to get in front of the arbitrators virtually, if not in person, on a frequent basis or at least a more frequent basis before the merits hearing. And to use every opportunity to educate them about the case. And the frequent use of virtual platforms makes that much easier. One innovation that I have not seen very often is the dispositive motions for summary judgment, which Jane talked about in the context of the new LCIA rules. Most of the rules now explicitly provide for dispositive motions. So the Hong Kong rules, the Stockholm Chamber, Singapore, ICSID, and now the LCIA. But at least in my experience, they are not often brought and they are rarely successful, at least in the international context. I see them used more often and more successfully in domestic arbitration. I think that's because the standard that is typically used in the rules, manifestly without merit in the LCIA rules and the ICSID rules, is a very high standard to meet. Chan mentioned that I used to do U.S. litigation, and in U.S. litigation, the standard is, at least for summary judgment, is that you can decide issues as a matter of law where there are no material facts in dispute as a matter of summary judgment. And it's an incredibly efficient way to dispose of issues that are, for example, clear and unambiguous on the contract and when there's no real factual dispute before the tribunal. And these motions can be very effective in narrowing the issues in dispute, if not disposing of the case altogether. I suspect that we will see more motions for summary disposition in international arbitration, and that, like other innovations, the more we see how well they work, the more willing we will be to use them. One last point that relates to all of the preceding points is the importance of the initial procedural conference in the age of virtual hearings. And Chan mentioned the chapter on the initial procedural conference in our book. All of the regimes covered in the book contemplate or at least refer to some type of initial pretrial conference or other type of communication to address the procedural issues at the outset of the case. Only the ICC, SEC, and the SEAC rules specifically require it. Now, I think they are incredibly important procedures in any circumstances, but in the age of virtual hearings, they are essential. It's also an incredible opportunity to work with the other side, to work with the tribunal, to think about how to tailor a procedure for the particular case at hand. And it is much easier to do that at the outset of the case before the parties become entrenched in procedural positions that they think will advantage their case on the merits. We often do initial procedural conferences by telephone, even in the largest of cases. Now that we know how easy it is to use a virtual hearing platform, they should always be done visually, except for perhaps in very small cases. The reality is that so much communication is visual. And yes, you lose something by not being in person in the room with the tribunal, but video is just vastly superior to telephone. So in conclusion, I mean, we all recognize the incredible pain and hardship that the COVID crisis has imposed on so many of us in so many different ways. But in the end, good things, meaningful change can arise out of crises. My hope is that we will take the creativity and the innovation that we've seen over the past 6 months or so, which have been born of necessity, and continue to use them to benefit international arbitration long after the crisis has ended. So, thank you. I'll pass it over to Ryan.
All right. Thank you, Alex. That was an excellent presentation, and I'll sort of follow on with my remarks. You know, if the current coronavirus epidemic has signaled the emergence of online hearings, I wonder if following the crisis, we're really seeing the end of in-person hearings. And so I just wanted to take a moment to pause and look before we leap through the looking glass. I noticed in reviewing the rules in the rule book that only a few of the major arbitral regimes provide for the use of video conference in certain situations, and there are four. One is for procedural conferences. The second is for expedited proceedings. The third is for emergency arbitration. And the fourth, under the IBA rules of evidence, is to use in exceptional circumstances for the testimony of a, quote, particular witness. But none of the major arbitral regimes imagine putting the entire hearing online, with the exception of LCIA rules 19.2, suggesting that you could possibly hold the hearing online or do some kind of combination of in-person and virtual hearing. We do have the sole protocol on video conferencing, but as has been noted by a publication by Linklaters, that is really geared towards interviewing a particular witness consistent with the IBA rules, but perhaps not for guiding parties and counsel and arbitrators on conducting the entire hearing online. And so I thought it might be useful to recall what is the significance of in-person hearings and why have we been doing it that way for centuries. And in my research, really the focus seems to be on assessing truth or falsehood of the testimony of fact witnesses. And this is perhaps for two reasons. One court that I came across considered that if a witness is going to not tell the truth, they might be find it easier to do so or be more inclined to do so from the comfort of their office talking to a video screen, as opposed to entering a hearing room facing the arbitrators, counsel, their peers, and former business partners. And so that might be a factor where in-person hearing is important. And the other one is assessing that witness credibility through the video conference. Right now, if I'm very nervous, I could be twiddling my thumbs, but you can't see that because they're off the screen, or I could be bouncing my knee up and down nervously. Those types of body language and nonverbal cues are lost. So there are a number of sources that make this particular observation and express this concern. And so perhaps cases that really turn on the credibility of a key witness testimony might not be appropriate to go online, or at least that portion of the case. There are, of course, other issues, even in such cases, that could be adequately addressed through video conference. And just thinking of, for example, in closing argument. So I was just saying that perhaps portions of hearings could be done online, especially through a hybrid approach, but that perhaps in certain cases, key witness testimony where credibility is critical might need to be in person. Turning back to the rule book, the issue of whether most or all of the hearing can be conducted online is really something that the arbitral regimes will want to address. And until then, parties may want to address this issue in their arbitration agreement. And in Chapter 2 of the rule book, we address a number of essential elements of arbitration agreements, highly recommended provisions, and other options. And within that framework, parties may want to add to the list discussion about whether to include something in the arbitration agreement about whether the hearing may be held online. And then I think that certain soft law guidelines would be useful in actually carrying out the conduct of an online hearing based on best practices. And until we have sort of official guidelines of that nature, as Alex mentioned, the time for parties to sketch out the procedures for online hearing is at the procedural conference. And that is addressed in Chapter 5 of the rule book. With a nod to this, ICDR rules Article 20.2 contemplate that at the preparatory conference, the tribunal and the parties may consider how technology may be used to increase the efficiency and economy of the proceedings. So that would be the moment to address that. And so I think I'll just close because I know we're running out of time. Certainly the coronavirus epidemic has pushed all of us out of our comfort zones in many ways, including in our practice of international arbitration. When those moments happen in our lives, that's when we grow and innovate. And I think that coming out of the epidemic, we will see increased use of online hearings in a variety of cases. And when we do so, I hope that we'll recall what might be lost in certain scenarios by foregoing the in-person hearing. And that's a discussion to have with clients for sure. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, and I think I'll turn it back over to Qian.
Yeah. Thank you, Ryan. And thank you all of you for your comprehensive explanations and perspectives. I think it's quite fruitful to have all of your perspectives. And we now have time for questions and answers, as Rekia has mentioned in the chat room. I know that we have one immediate question. So before I get to my questions, I think we should take the question from the audience. And that is, now that the hearings are virtual, what will be the seat of arbitration, especially if it's not in the contract? Does anybody want to field that?
I can field that.
Great.
If the seat of arbitration is not indicated in the arbitration agreement, most regimes leave it to the arbitrator to decide the seat. And then, of course, we know that the seat of arbitration is not necessarily the physical place where the hearing is held. It has legal significance for determining what is the applicable arbitration law and significance for enforcing the award. But under most regimes, the tribunal can elect to hold the hearing and any other meetings at a location that is not the seat without undermining that choice of seat. Whether choosing another place for the hearing includes cyberspace is sort of a new question for all of us to think about.
So can I just add to that, Ryan?
Sure.
Bit of feedback. There's a very strong line of case law in England that says that if you have a choice of law, a choice of English law in the contract, there's a very strong implication that you intended the situs of the arbitration, absent other indications, to be in England. And so I agree absolutely with everything you said, but that is the kind of factor that would have to be weighed in by a tribunal, I think.
Thank you. So I don't think, based on what Rekia has indicated, that there are any other questions from the floor yet, but we do welcome questions, so do please send them over. In the meantime, a few questions of my own. Now, all of you have described trends and rule changes. Now, from a practitioner's perspective, how do you feel about the rule changes? For example, the LCIA rules were last revised in 2014, and 6 years they have been revised again. And this seems to be a trend that institutions have been revising their rules every give or take 5 years, whereas perhaps in the previous decade or two, there was much more time in between rule changes. How does that affect your practice?
We had anticipated that there would be rule changes when we were putting the book together, and I think that change is good, but it needs to be necessary. I think that the question that the arbitral institutions need to grapple with is the degree to which the rule changes that are being recommended are the result of competition and wanting to be viewed as innovators rather than as opposed to rules that need to be changed because of need. And I think that the question of necessity has to be borne out of actual practice and not just theoretical aspiration or competitive imperative. I look at ICSID's process that ICSID has gone through, and it's been a very, very deliberate process. It's been one. Now, of course, the ICSID regime is very different compared to some of the other commercial arbitration regimes, and so it necessarily involves a significant input from various stakeholders. But it has been a process that's been very transparent. It's been very deliberate. It's been very well thought through. And I think the changes are the function of or the outcome of considerable experience with the issues that arbitrations have raised and that arbitrators have confronted. So, you know, I would hope that there aren't these constancy of changes, not simply because of self-interest and not having, you know, the desire to get into addition too quickly. But I think we need to be thoughtful, very clear-eyed about what it is that these changes are addressing. Now, there is one comment I would like to make and associate, and based on remarks that Ryan was making or made about virtual hearings. I think one of the biggest issues that we will need to contend with is the degree to which the virtual hearing or the virtual space is unable to accommodate cross-cultural differences. I mean, there are people who come from cultures who are not comfortable being on a screen. I mean, just take a very simple example. There may be individuals who, because of their accents, their testimony may be harder to capture. And because of the constraints of a virtual space, we may, arbitrators may not be able to fully appreciate the nuance, the body language, or the tone and emphasis of a particular witness or counsel. And so I think we need to be extremely, extremely sensitive to the imposition of homogenized platforms or these virtual platforms on parties without that may not have the level of comfort. I mean, leaving aside the technological wherewithal or the technological capacity to be able to have the necessary bandwidth or the tech support, but I think that there is a softer side to this that we can't underestimate. And let's say you have three arbitrators who all happen to come from Western countries, and you have or Northern countries, and you have parties who happen to be from what I call the majority world, but others call the developing world. Those parties, there's a question mark there as to the degree to which the arbitrators will truly be able to appreciate what is being lost, and may overcompensate by imposing their own cultural and social lens in terms of appreciating what a witness is saying. Some may say that's a good thing because it essentially means that you're simply looking at the words and not the emphasis of the witness. But I do think that where, as Ryan was saying, credibility is an issue, we do need to, account for what gets lost as a result of virtuality.
Thank you, Arif. I think that's an interesting point, and something I've certainly seen in my hearings in terms of cross-cultural connectivity via virtual hearings, in particular in relation to language, where English is not your second language. I think that there is some stalling in terms of connectivity on screen. So thank you for that. I wanted to draw our attention to soft law guidelines. Now, you kind of indicated now that, you know, rules should be changed out of necessity. But certainly over time, through experience, many institutions will see the need for tweaks in language, et cetera, or soft law, practice notes, et cetera. What are your views on that? And that's something that I think is quite interesting to kind of expand upon as we look at the second edition of your book.
I guess I can take that one. You know, what we see happening now is that cases are in progress. We have procedural orders in place, and suddenly it's determined that the case has to be heard virtually. So we scrambled to put together procedural orders that deal with the challenges of having a virtual hearing, how to get the exhibits to the witness, how to make sure that the witness isn't being coached. So, you know, you have these elaborate procedures in the procedural orders that, that require the witness to turn the camera 360 degrees before the testimony, you know, some of which I think are a little bit silly. But as we begin to see all the different orders and figure out what the best practices are, they will be incorporated into soft law protocols like the Samah Haridi's protocol that Arif mentioned. And I think that they will be useful in not only helping us debate what the best practices are, but coming to a consensus as to what the best practices are. So I know some people are quite skeptical of soft law. I tend to think that soft law can be quite useful, and I think it will be in this context.
And picking up on something that Jane said is that if you look at the arbitral regimes, the whole set of rules often is a few pages. And I think that the institutions do well not to be too prescriptive on the details of how the arbitration is supposed to go, or else you trade off the flexibility that Alex was talking about. And so in my mind, I could imagine an amendment to the rules that's a single provision that says something about whether and when video conference for an entire hearing might be appropriate, and then something that looks like, you know, the IVA guidelines on evidence, something like that for how to conduct the online hearing.
Okay, thank you. So another question in relation to trends is Jane, you have mentioned all the different aspects of the LCIA rules and them incorporating the various trends that have existed in the various rules in recent years, including early determination. In their early iteration, they had also the power to remove party representatives, for example. Now, what do you think is next? Or maybe I should ask, what else do you think that the LCIA could have addressed, but maybe decided not to address in their rules? And do you see any trends in the pipeline that may be worth mentioning?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Shan. A couple of things. I was surprised, I have to say, that the LCIA did not include anything in these revisions on expedited hearings. The majority of the institutions, certainly the majority of those we covered in the book, do have some really quite detailed provisions on expedited hearings. Arif referred to this a little earlier, but the LCIA rules are not developed on that, and I would have expected to see something on that. Although, on reflection, the LCIA is quite a nimble institution, and perhaps it feels that it can deal with those situations as and when they arise rather than having something in the rules. And of course, as I think each of us has mentioned at some time or another, one of the great virtues of arbitration is exactly that. It's the flexibility that it gives you without being tied down to court rules such as the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure or the English White Book, which tend to put litigants in something of a straitjacket and prevent the kind of flexibility that's available in arbitration. So maybe that's it. I was also surprised not to see anything more detailed about virtual hearings in the LCIA revisions. I would have thought that those would have been something the LCIA would have been considering even before COVID, and certainly from March onwards, where they've been living the reality of dealing with virtual hearings. So I would have thought that those issues would be addressed. Perhaps there too, the flexibility that the LCIA rules allow make something explicit on those things unnecessary, although I would wager that in the next round of amendments, we'll see both of those questions addressed.
Great, thank you.
I'll add to what Jane said. I think that the soft law guidelines that are emerging and will continue to emerge, I think, will provide some guidance. I think that I would be very hesitant for institutions to try and act too quickly. I mean, as I said at the outset, I really do believe that the rules as they currently exist are sufficient in terms of a framework, and they're sufficiently broad to accommodate a variety of scenarios. And we don't know yet everything that we're going to have to deal with going forward. And so it may be that practice guidelines or hearing guidelines or arbitrator guidelines can be issued. And, you know, we need this to mature a little bit before we, you know, rush into over-regulating. And I've been very opposed to over-regulation in the context of international arbitration, because I think that with this overregulation, we're losing one of the critical building blocks of the international arbitral system, which is party autonomy.
Great, thank you. I think we have time for one more question from the floor, even though I have pages of questions for you. And the question from the floor is manifestly without legal merit the same as manifest disregard of the law? If no, how do they differ?
Well, that's a very good question, and one that occurred to me when I read these new rules as well. Mm-hmm. And it's an argument I fully expect that we will see fleshed out in the very near future. It seems to me that the word manifestly must have been chosen for a reason. Time will tell. That's as far as I'm going to go on that.
You know, I was actually just reading about manifest disregard of the law. So manifestly without merit would refer to a claim that's really got no legs. And manifest disregard of the law is much later. It's at the time of the final award and evaluating whether the arbitrator might have exceeded his or her powers by really failing to apply the law at all. And that would be a potential ground in some jurisdictions for setting aside the award. So two different contexts using the same similar language.
That's really helpful, actually. Yeah. Thank you. So we don't have any more questions from the floor. I'm happy to ask one more question or end early. I guess parting words, maybe. If you could give 30 seconds worth of parting words as to what you see your biggest change that you see will last after COVID? What do you think we will see in the new norm?
I'll tell you what I hope we don't see. I hope we don't see simply a return to the pre-COVID world, right? I mean, I think there will be some temptation to go back to what we were comfortable with, to go back to all of the pre-COVID norms. I think in many ways, many of us long for the pre-COVID norms. But there have been such good innovations that have come out of this, and I hope they continue to be used, and I hope they continue to be advanced even after COVID is over, which I hope will be sooner rather than later.
Thank you.
Well, I think ultimately, I think the biggest winners, in some respects, if there are any winners, in a horrendous situation that we're all having to contend with on so many levels. But being very clinical about it, it's the clients, the users. I think that as we go into areas that we were forcing us to not do things according to the tried, true, and tested ways, it goes back to a time in arbitration where we really were looking at a dispute and trying to come up with a procedural framework that would focus on that's most appropriate for that particular dispute and the set of issues that it raises. So I think that there is this opportunity now for clients to reflect their true, what their real commercial objectives are. And I think what is going to be a more flexible and innovative environment, and clients will be able to make that choice between, or do that cost benefit analysis between the virtual hearing versus the in-person hearing. They will be able to take a greater role, and should take a greater role, in fashioning the procedure that is relevant for the particular dispute that's at hand, taking into consideration their commercial objectives, not just the lawyers' financial objectives or their procedural prejudices.
Two things, really. Arbitration has always had a reputation for its flexibility and adaptability. And the days of COVID are days to show its mettle in that regard. And I very much hope that the flexibility that arbitration tribunals and practitioners can show will bleed across into court systems, so that court systems too can let go of some of the straitjackets in which they tend to operate. There have been some fabulous examples of that in the last few months, and I hope everybody will take stock. The second thing is those of us who are fortunate enough to be in a position to continue with our work in these very odd circumstances have, I think, all learnt the value of having time to reflect. We're not rushing around from lunch to drinks with somebody to catching the train home to all the things that we used to do in the old normal. And I think there's a very great deal of value in that time for reflection that these more static days have given us. And I hope we don't lose that.
Thank you. And Ryan, how about you?
Well, I teach a course on international arbitration at Duke, and I think that I will incorporate some discussion and some practice with the virtual hearing. Not so much to teach my students about it, but so that they can teach me. I think that the next generation of lawyers, especially those that have gone through the VEES competition, which was held online last spring and which will be held online again next year, we'll have some keen insights. And, you know, heading into a virtual hearing this past summer, I really wished I had experimented with it in law school. And so I hope to be able to provide that to students. And I think we'll see that at other law schools as well.
And you, and your final words, Chan, we want to hear your thoughts.
Oh, well, I mean, I have to say I do echo so much of what you've said, but I do hope that we do not return to the old normal. I think there are so many gems within international arbitration that we can really utilize. And a lot of that has to do with case management techniques that are already at our disposal. And we just have to exercise our powers to be able to be flexible and innovative with basic tools of procedure. And I hope that we will continue to create new procedure and bespoke procedure for specific cases going forward and adapt as such. So thank you very much for inviting me to moderate the session. And thank you, participants, for joining. It's been a real pleasure for me. I don't know who's signing off, but it's, if it's me, then good day to everyone. And thank you again.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you very much.